Tallis, and he was so taken with it, he wrote that Fantasia on a theme of Thomas Tallis. It premiered in 1910. The Atlanta Symphony Orchestra strings played that, and they were led by Robert Spano. I'm Lynn Werfel. Thanks for your company.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone, where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. A UFO researcher and author, Mr. Terry Tabendo, hails from Canada. His book, Global Evidence of the UFO and ETI Presence, is the first book in the series of six volumes that was originally written as a single 3,500-page tome entitled A Citizen's Disclosure on UFOs and ETI. Together, this series of books are the most comprehensive and definitive books of their kind, offering the novice a clear path for future research, as well as offering the seasoned UFO investigator some thought-provoking alternative insights. Each volume stands complete, filled with hundreds of colored photographs presenting the best evidence of the UFO and ETI phenomenon from a citizen's perspective, that draws from the author's 65 years of personal experiences, contacts, research, and investigations. Although new to the literary world, his background and understanding of the phenomena spans over 60 years of personal UFO sightings and ET contact, which began when he was 5 years old, followed by a lifetime of many otherworldly sightings and encounters. Terry attended the University of Victoria, majoring in astronomy, physics, math, and other sciences, yet everything he was studying was always leading him in his search for answers that would bring him closer to understanding the nature and reality of extraterrestrial life in the universe. And we're fortunate to have him on the line with us so we can pick his brain on the ET subject. Hello, Terry.
Hi, David. Good afternoon.
It's good to have you on the show with us.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So, tell our listeners, if you would, how you first became involved with otherworldly phenomena.
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, I've had many UFO sightings and experiences with ETI, and my first one began when I was about 5 years old. My father was in the Royal Canadian Air Force, and we got transferred around quite a bit, from Victoria to North Bay, Ontario, to St. Jean's, Quebec, and then over into England and back again. And along the way, in St. Jean's, Quebec, my mother and I were going out for a walk with my younger baby brother, and as we were on the military base, I looked up in the sky and I saw this strange circular object, which was obviously a flying saucer, disc shape, dark underneath, dome on the top, very light on the top. And I said to my mother, "What's that?" And she said, looking at it rather puzzlingly, she said, "I think it's an airplane." Whereupon it zigzagged back out from where it flew in. Now, the interesting thing about this is this was a daylight sighting. This was probably somewhere of a distance of 500 to 1,000 feet away from us. So it was fairly close. And I would estimate now, thinking back on it, that this was probably a structure somewhere between 35 to 50 feet in diameter. And that was the first UFO sighting that I had. And then within a couple of days, a day or two, at night, I had ETs come into my bedroom. And they literally materialized right through the wall behind the bedroom door. And when I saw these strange beings, which seemed to be diminutive, they kind of glowed and looked to me like Casper the Ghost. And I was freaked out because I thought, now we've got ghosts or little men coming into the room and they shouldn't be there. And I was calling out to my mother in almost sheer panic. And she came running in and said, "What's going on?" And I said, "There's little men behind the door." And she says, "I think you're dreaming." Mm-hmm. And she went and looked behind the door, and she said, "Well, there's nothing there." Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to, you know, persuade her that, yeah, they're definitely there. And she said, "No, you're just dreaming. I want you to calm down and go back to sleep and not to think about that." She goes out of the door, goes to her own room, and sure enough, these little guys come back through the wall again. So I thought, well, obviously she didn't see them, but they're there, and so I'm calling out again, and now I'm waking up the whole house with my hysterics, and she comes running back in, and she said, "You woke up the whole house. What's going on?" And I said, "They're back again." And as a five-year-old child, you know, you just don't know what's going on, and sometimes you see things that other people don't see, but you know that they're real. And so she calms me back down, and she tells me to think about Christmas. It's not too far away, and that gives me a timeline that this was roughly in November, late November, when I had this experience. And she goes back out after calming me down, and she says, "No more crying." Goes back out, and sure enough, for a third time, these little beings come out, and they're walking around now the edge of my bed towards where I'm sleeping at the front. And I decided that that moment, I'm pulling the covers over my head. I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to scream. And I figured if I can't see them, they can't see me. Therefore, they're not there.
The ostrich effect, huh?
That's right. And the funny thing is, I shared this bedroom with my twin brother and my baby brother, and obviously the baby brother didn't see anything, but I would have thought my twin brother would have seen this, and he has no recollection of anything like this happening. And in the morning we discussed it and said, "You're just having a bad dream, you know, your mind's playing games on you," this sort of thing. So I kind of put it out of my consciousness for the most part, but I found that I was drawing pictures of things like stars, planets, rocket ships and stuff, which I had no real knowledge of at that point. So where was this all coming from?
All right. You know, it's surprising that, you know, I can understand your brother. How old was your brother at the time?
We were both 5 years old. Oh. And the younger brother, the baby brother, was a year old.
Okay, so you were
this
twin?
This was back in 1953.
Were you a twin? Are you a twin?
Well, I'm a fraternal twin, yes.
Oh, okay.
So if you've seen the movie Twins, Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, yeah. You're, well, you're the big one, right?
Yeah, I'm the big one, and he's the small one.
Okay.
So,
given we're on the radio, we'll let that go.
Yeah. So, but there you go. And, you know, the thing is, from that point on, I've always had experiences where I'm moving around across the country or living in some other location, whether that was in Britain or back in Canada. And what I found was that they always seemed to be fairly close to home. In other words, within miles, but within observable sight.
Right.
And when I see these things, they're not aircraft, because as we grew up, as I said, my father was in the Air Force, we knew what aircraft were.
Yeah.
And so seeing something with a fuselage and wings and whatnot, we knew that that was, you know, man-made. What I saw and on these other occasions was something totally different, something like a ball of plasma or a fluorescent light-type object. Didn't have the same light configurations. So, you know, I started to know what was man-made and what wasn't.
Well, going back to your first experience when you and your brother were five, it's understandable that usually people around the experiencer or contactee, whatever you want to call them, is switched off by these for some way by ET. But usually the abductee or experiencer is also switched off. So it seems amazing that you weren't switched off so that you couldn't be crying out. You know, even at the age of five, you couldn't be crying out. It was, you know, victims usually, or subjects, however you want to categorize yourself, always say that they're turned off, they can't move, they can't yell. And
I've read those accounts, and you know, that's true. I think everybody has sometimes a slightly different experience.
Right.
Some may be more negative than others, some more positive than others.
Right.
What I was experiencing was something that was happening in real time. And these beings, though they had this sort of ability to move through the walls almost like you expect a ghost or a spirit, they were obviously using some form of technology. One of the interesting things is when I had the covers over my head, I did fall asleep, but there was something in the back of my mind that said those covers came off me. What happened after that, I have no recollection of. So it could be that, as you're saying, you know, you get turned off, and maybe the other part of the experience was something that my consciousness didn't need to recollect at that point.
Right.
And perhaps under hypnosis I might recall it, but I've never had hypnosis. So, you know, I've just come to the conclusion, hey, ETs exist, and there's life in the universe, and that's the end of all things, you know, sort of thing.
Right.
I just accept that.
Right. So, yeah, how do you know that these weren't actually spirits?
Well, when I was living in England, the first home we moved into was a fairly old sort of Elizabethan-style home, and we knew that somebody had died in this home.
Nice.
And it turned out it was an elderly lady. And interestingly enough, my father was leaving the home, and he was going out, I think, to the local pub or something like that. And he said, go to the window, and I'll take a picture of all you know, people looking out the window. So we did that. And when he developed the slide, which is, you know, the what we all used to have and put in the slide machine to view it, and it was in color, right above my head was this ghostly apparition.
No kidding.
And when you looked at it, it looked like an elderly lady.
Hmm.
So we knew, I mean, we had strange things happening in that house. So we knew at that point that what we were dealing with was more paranormal as opposed to extraterrestrial or something else.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't poltergeist. This was an apparition, and different parts of the house would be cold, and you could go into a room and breathe and see your breath on the atmosphere.
Really? That cold?
Yeah. We had a dog, and the dog used to run around crazy as if somebody was chasing it.
Yeah.
We had a bed warmer that used to hang off the hook by the fireplace, and it used to fall off the hook. And so how do you explain all of that? You know, that that shouldn't move at all.
What time of the year was this when you could see your breath?
Well, we were there in from, I think, late summer through to winter into January. So we were there for about 5 or 6 months. So there would be different times. There was one room in the house nobody ever used. It was, it had furniture and stuff, and that was the room that you could see your breath in. Like, I went up there a couple of times and checked, and, you know, it was odd. I didn't want to stay in that room. I think that's where the old lady died.
But was the heater on in that room? Was the heat on in the room?
Well, no, no. The heater wasn't on. Now, you know, because at that time, we weren't getting the same kind of winters that Canada would get or in the States. So, though there might have been a bit of snow, we had the fireplace on in all the other places, but in this one room, which we had no use for, we didn't obviously heat it up. And what we would have is a actual fireplace in there. Hmm. It wasn't like a radiator or anything else. So you'd have to sort of stoke the fireplace with coal or wood in order to get some heat in there.
But it should not have been that cold to
see
your breath. Wow. So maybe we are talking about something different than the UFO phenomena. Maybe we're talking about ghostly phenomenon here. But, you know, I think there's a connection between spiritual phenomenon and ET. I think they're on a different... in a different dimension that breaks through to ours. What's your opinion on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, and this is one of the things I discuss in my book. And by the way, you know, the book is available from Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Ingram Spark, or go to your local bookstore, and if you don't see it, ask them to order it in. Now, what I was going to say is that there are many similarities and parallels from the spiritual side of existence and what are extraterrestrial and their technology. And sometimes when you go out, if you're ghost hunting and you're going into a graveyard or possibly a haunted home or building of some kind, you might see some orbs floating around.
Right.
And the people who are the ghost hunters will obviously pick this up on their devices and have a reading or two. They might even hear strange noises. When they play it back, they may hear actual voices saying something. When we go out and we're investigating UFOs and ETs and trying to make contact with them, we may see orbs, but they behave differently, and they don't necessarily convey any sound or any thought patterns or anything. They just kind of, they're almost like a surveillance of some kind, some sort of drone of ET origin moving about. And they'll be the size of a grapefruit or a basketball, and then they just suddenly whip away off into some direction, and you just catch a quick glimpse of it. Other times we'll see craft with its disc-shaped, triangular, or what have you, or just a blob of light. So there is a distinction between the two. And when we are doing what we call contact and communications, which is known in the UFO community as CE5, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, then that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make contact, and what we want is the craft to come close to us and hopefully, if possible, to land and have their occupants come out and meet with us. Now, in that,
I take it they have not?
Yes, they have, actually.
Talk to me.
And the interesting thing is, it's not in the manner that you would expect that you would see in on Hollywood movies like Close Encounters of the Third Kind or Ancient Aliens and all the rest of it. What happens, and Carl Sagan summed this up very well, if it's truly alien and alien technology, it would appear to us as almost like magic. And that's how they do interact with us. They, if they're operating in interdimensional technology, they're on the, what they call the crossing point of light between physicality and that interdimensionality from which they're coming from or traveling through. And they bleed through into our reality. And so sometimes what people will describe is like a door is suddenly opening and then shutting as the craft either appears or disappears. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just like a snap of the fingers and they're gone. And you don't even see any portal or anything. Other times you do. So the thing is, what we're saying is these ETs will appear almost like a hologram before us. Mm-hmm. They're not physically there, yet we can see them. And other times we can sense their presence or even have them come up and touch us, yet we cannot touch them in return. So what that allows them to do is to be safe in this physical condition or in this on this planet where they can interact with people without the possibility of any hostility coming from us or the possibility of even the cross-contamination of bacteria back and forth, alien or human.
All right. I need to take a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with researcher and author Terry Tabendo. Terry Tabendo in Canada. And we're talking about communicating now with ET, although you say that they're not really quite physical. They're more ethereal.
Well, I would say yes to that, but you know, this does not exclude the possibility that they do show up physically, mm-hmm. and that there is the physical interaction with people. Now, as I was saying, that you know, if you go to a country and you spend some time there, whether that be, say, India, China, Africa, wherever, and if you're associating with people, there's a good chance that you may be picking up a virus, flu, or something. Mm. And you come back and you end up with a cold for a couple of weeks and then you're over it. Well, you have to understand that we're dealing with extraterrestrial entities, beings from another planet or star system, and their whole biology may be completely different from us. Even though there may be some similarities, it's going to be different. That means they may have their own diseases and bacteria on their planet, and we have ours. So we have to be really careful when, if they do show up physically, we're hoping that they're advanced enough that they have dealt with the medical issues of cross-communication or cross-contamination of diseases and bacteria. So when they're in this interdimensional state, which is, as I say, the closest thing I can describe it as, is hologram or holographic, then that's safe for them.
No.
And therefore, they can interact with us. Now, they can interact with our electronics, and there's ample evidence of this, not only on simple devices like magnetometers and radar detectors, but they can interfere with aircraft, with ships,
really?
With power lines, and all the rest of it. So what they're doing is they're just saying, hey, we're here, and your beeps and tones that you're hearing from your magnetometers, we can actually influence that.
Mm-hmm.
And we can make it go slow or fast. We can operate two radar detectors, and one will go off in the X-band, and the other one will go off on the Y-band.
Mm.
And so how is that possible when they both have those features?
Mm-hmm.
So their technology allows them to tune in to the frequency and manipulate that that device.
Right. You're probably familiar with the case quite a few years ago in Brazil where the two little girls saw the alien crouching down trying to hide, and they ran home and told their mother they saw the devil.
Yeah.
Remember that one?
Yeah, that that was quite remarkable case. That was in Virginia, Brazil. Actually, it was three children that saw that. I think they were all girls.
Three girls, yeah. And
they were coming home, and up against this wall, which I think was either part of the building or part of a wall that went around some buildings, they saw this creature that they described as kind of brown-skinned, and it had three bumps on its head and red eyes.
Right.
And when they saw the eyes, and it made a kind of a buzzing noise, they were saying, oh, al diablo, al diablo, the devil, right?
Right, right.
And so they ran off home saying, we saw the devil, to their parents. And, of course, the parents were probably thinking that their imaginations or they're just making it up.
Oh, sure.
But the interesting thing is that one of the leading ufologists of Brazil was investigating this because he had heard that there was a crash that came down near their city, and he was about a half hour behind the event as it unfolded. What happened was the military and the fire department were running around hearing reports of strange creatures, and they came across one down a ravine, and the fire department went down there and threw a net over the thing, captured it, and then they dragged it back up and they placed it in a box, and they put a lid on it and nailed it closed. You know, welcome to the planet Earth.
This is right.
Extraterrestrial. Right. And then the military took hold of this, and they got it off to a hospital where they wanted a doctor to investigate it. Along the way, one of the soldiers had touched the creature, and within a matter of, I think it was either hours or a couple of days, he died.
A couple of days, yeah. Yeah, and, that was to your point about the diseases that one will carry and not affect them because their immune system's used to it, but you take it to another planet and they're toast.
Right? Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. And that's why we got to be really careful. And it also brings up a lot of other questions that need to be asked, and that is, if we're seeing physical ETs running around and they're actually interacting with people, have they solved the problem of, you know, diseases and bacteria and other medical issues, or are these even real ETs? In other words, could they be programmable life forms? And there are evidences for this, not only in the States, in Britain, in Canada, Australia, where these little beings are actually being created, hybridization and cloning, and they're done in underground facilities. And one of the facilities in England is Peacemore, and it's an underground facility. And a witness to one of these beings was a security guard for the facility, and he said that he had seen an operating room where these beings were being created, and not just what they looked like, small grays, but he said they were also producing what appeared to be tall reptilians. And one such reptilian actually was being escorted down a corridor and past him and by two large humans, and this extraterrestrial reptilian-type being, at least that's what he thought it was, just they all kept looking straight forward, and he said this reptilian looked so strong and powerful, he could have easily taken out everybody in the hallway. But for some reason, he was under control and being escorted down the hallway. So he said, listen, this stuff is real, and I will swear to this. And he's made YouTube videos, and he's been on various programs talking to other ufologists about this. And he said, this is real. And he says, this program is worldwide. It isn't just in Britain. It's not just in the States. And there are many places in southwestern United States where these beings are being created, but also up in Canada. And Canada has a habit of keeping its mouth shut. They don't say a lot.
Right.
And so they seem to keep a better secret of it than anything else. But I have an idea of where I think some of these beings are being created, but it's purely speculation, of course.
There's Dulce. Dulce underground.
Dulce and Dugway and a few others. Papoose, yeah. You know, and the thing is, like, the one that I suspect in Canada is probably close to Toronto. I think it's near Moulton, Ontario. And there are sightings of vehicles going into Ontario Lake and disappearing and then coming back out again. And I suspect that they're going underwater and then into an underground facility that can only be entered through the water.
You say there's UFOs going in there?
That's right. Yeah. I know of somebody that had filmed this over a number of weeks, and she said there would always be two or three of these objects over the Ontario Lake, and I was supposed to Lake Erie and what have you, but she said she would see these things, and then all of a sudden they would seem to submerge, and where she was located was just outside of Toronto. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that there's something very close nearby.
Oh, and you figure the oceans are the best place to hide in this whole world, you know?
Well, yeah. I think that there's something off the coast of San Francisco. I think there's off of Vancouver Island. I think there's another one because a lot of people on Vancouver Island see UFOs, and that's where I saw a lot of them myself. So you start to put it together, you know, and all of a sudden the pieces start to fit.
Yeah.
And when you get more and more evidence, it just builds up the picture.
Right. And the recent admission by the Navy and the Air Force and by Parliament. The Pentagon Parliament. I wish we had Parliament. Anyway, by
wrong country.
Wrong country. Oh, where am I anyway? By the Pentagon, with a Tic Tac, those what they call the Tic Tac sightings, was hovering. They came down and hovered right over a spot on the ocean, over the ocean. But beneath the ocean, they could see this round, dark object, and they were hovering over that. Now, what's the connection, you know?
Well, you know, the thing that I think most ufologists are now sort of recognizing is, yeah, they're not only aerial, they're submersible. And in fact, I would say that they have the ability to move through solid objects. And there are cases where, for instance, what appeared to be initially what was thought to be an airplane turned out to be a UFO, probably very similar to what they would call a Tic Tac, which is nothing more than a disc shape or a cigar shape craft. And so there's this new terminology of Tic Tac, UAP, unidentified aerial phenomena, which is essentially UFOs.
Right.
And if the truth be known, it's extraterrestrial vehicles, ETVs.
Right.
But they're not going to come out and say that right off the bat because, you know, that's the giveaway. So the term Tic Tac and UAP, et cetera, I think is a new nomenclature given to get people to rethink this in terms of how the military are seeing it. And it's also aimed at the younger generation. You know, you and I probably have grown up with this for decades, and so we kind of know what's going on, and we've read the history and the research behind all of this, and we know the military involvement. So what we're seeing here is when we talk about advanced aerospace threat identification, AATIP, which is derived out of the Pentagon, and with Tom DeLonge's TTSA, To the Stars Academy, they're putting a spin on this. And Tom DeLonge is a former rock band leader of Blink 182. So he was approached by various military and intelligence people from the Pentagon and they said, look, we can give you information if you wish to disclose this. Well, what they were doing was feeding him their particular brand of what was really happening, and it's all from the military point of view. And so when you're watching programs like Unidentified with Luis Elizondo, then what you are getting is a military and a somewhat negative perspective on this. In other words, right. they're treating this as hostile, mm-hmm. potentially hostile. And yet, for decades, and I've been doing this for 25 years, and the CSETI movement, which started by Dr. Greer, has been operating a little bit longer, has had nothing but positive experiences.
That's right.
Nobody's been abducted. Nobody's had a medical procedure. Nobody's missing time. And when we come away from the nighttime event, we all have had a positive experience. Sometimes the ETs show up and they interact with us. Other times we see things above us, whether in high orbit or nearby, and it's all positive. So how do you justify the two negative or the two aspects, one negative, one positive?
I've had, this show has been going on for 13 and a half years on WHFR, and 10 years before that on a local TV station. And I have had, it's like every other week I have someone who thinks they're negative, and every other week someone who thinks they're positive, malevolent beings, benevolent beings, and indifferent beings, you know? So they all have different viewpoints on it. And Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs both think that they were hostile and they're trying to take us over. I think that if that were the case, we wouldn't be having this conversation. What do you think?
Well, I agree. And, you know, the thing is, they've done some pretty good research, but I don't think they've done enough. I mean, when I was writing my book, the thing that I found was that I had to put aside all those things that I thought were correct and positive and all the rest of it, and realize that some of it was an error. In fact, the book is really written in such a style as to correct what I call bad or gross error in the UFO database. And I know now that some ufologists are recognizing that the material and data that we've gathered over the centuries, or not centuries, decades, that
right.
has come from questionable sources. And I'm not talking about the people who are hoaxers and want to be in the limelight, but people who claim that they may be military or associated with the military as a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to disparage all of them, because obviously there's a lot more evidence that they've seen that the rest of us will never see.
Right.
However, what we're trying to say is, look, there is some bad, flawed error in the database, and it needs to be re-looked at, re-examined, and yes, it's going to take more time to go through it, but at the end, I think we'll come out with some positive stuff. I mean, in my book, for instance, one of the things that a lot of ufologists would discuss and say there were UFOs in our ancient past, and it shows up even biblically. One of the minor prophets in the Old Testament is Ezekiel, and he had a sighting of a wheel within a wheel,
mm-hmm.
and creatures with wings and foreheads, and wherever way they went, they went, sort of thing. Well, what I have found as I read through that chapter is that right off the bat, Ezekiel says, "I had a vision of the Lord." He doesn't say, "I had a vision of some strange event," though it was apparently strange to him, because
right.
what he was trying to do was to understand what he was seeing. What I also found out at the end of that chapter is he again reinstates that this was a vision of the Lord. So when you look at anything that is stated in the Bible as a vision or even a form of prophecy, then that's the way you got to take it. It's not meant to be literal. And what I found was that the wheel within the wheel actually is a description of the plane of the ecliptic and the how the stars and the planets move around. And when he says there were eyes within the wheel, these are the stars. And when he talks about the beings that had four heads and four wings, These are the four cardinal points on the zodiac compass. Mm-hmm. So when you look at it, you can find the Taurus, the bull, the human, which is, would be Aquarius, the eagle, which is a reference, I think, to Scorpio, and the other one was, it slipped my mind.
The bull,
yeah, and I think the other one was the ram or something like that. But the thing is, there is a drawing of these creatures on a zodiac picture showing those points. So all of a sudden, this starts to make a lot more sense.
That doesn't explain the fact that Ezekiel said this wheel within a wheel came down and touched the ground, made noise like an army or rushing water, and touched the ground, and people got out and took him aboard and picked him up and took him off. Now, where is that coming from?
I don't know which Bible you're reading. But all I'm saying is, based on I've got the whole chapters or the whole verses from that chapter, and you know, this is going to be one of those controversial aspects that you're not going to get an agreement from everybody on.
No, you're not,
because it affects their religious belief.
That's it.
As well as their outlook on how the universe is, mm-hmm. whether that's ET or whether it's just human beings.
Right, right.
But the thing that I'm getting at here is, I mean, it talks about the throne of God descending. And my understanding from that, having discussed with this with people from both sides of religion and from ufology, is that represents the kingdom of God and the law of God descending on earth.
Mm.
And with all the noise and the din that was taking place and the light that burnished like bronze or gold is all an aspect of the glory of that situation. As I said, the thing to bear in mind is Ezekiel himself said it was a vision.
Right.
And so we have to go by that, because if you had a sighting of something, you're going to say, we saw this, we saw that.
And it was a vision.
but it's not a vision. But when you're clarifying that, then you're realizing that this is something else. Bear in mind that most of all holy religious texts is on the spiritual aspect and nature of humanity. It isn't really a history book. It isn't really a science book. It is a book based on how does humans behave with other humans or towards other humans. What is their true nature, and this nature, the nature that in which they are living in, and what should they do now in order to prepare for the afterlife? And so, in that essence, we're getting a bit of an insight here that humanity is also interdimensional.
Right.
And another word for interdimensional is spiritual.
I have to take one more moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I am David Twitchell, and we're speaking with researcher and author Terry Tabando from Canada. And let's see, we were talking. Okay, let's go to this. Because I wanted to get this in. You referred in your book to the holographic universe and the holographic consciousness and the variations in between. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I need to refresh my mind myself just looking at it, because I wrote so much down.
Yeah.
So just give me a moment here. I'll try not to take too long. Essentially, I think most people will recognize that the holographic universe is the fact that everything, whether it be on the microscopic level or the quantum level, is a replication of sorts to the macro universe. In other words, if we look at the atom, we see that it has both a proton and electrons and neutrons about it. And they move around in circles. Well, if we look at the universe, it's the same thing. We have the sun, which is similar to the proton, and we have the various planets, which could be the electrons, and the neutrons would be the moons, the satellites. Well, that's part of the holographic universe. It's a fractal of something smaller or something larger to that which is smaller. So the thing is that when we look at the holographic universe, and I talk about this as a paradigm, because this was something that was brought up by Albert Einstein and Podolsky and Rosen, and they talked about it in quantum mechanics. And I'm not going to try and be a scientist or even pretend that I know all the scientific evidence behind this, but essentially that objective reality does not exist, that despite its apparent solidarity, the universe is a heart of a phantasm, a gigantic and splendidly detailed hologram. And that's from Alan Aspect's findings. And so that's what we're dealing with. When we look at things like the super hologram, what we're saying is essentially the same thing, that the super hologram is a reality and plucked out of scenes from the long-forgotten past. This suggests that even the proper tools, it might be even possible to someday reach into that super holographic universe.
Right.
All of this is the beginning and the end are one and the same, the Alpha and Omega. Okay, so now we're saying that there is essentially no real physicality, and that there is no aspect of real time, that we can measure time based on events, but essentially what was past is present and it is future all at one at the same time. That's part of that.
So you think of the book, I can't remember the author now, maybe you do,
Holographic Universe.
Right. What's the
talks about all that.
Right, he does. And he talks about you take a picture of an apple and take one pixel out of that picture, and with that one pixel, you can create the entire picture of an apple.
That's correct. And that's, you can do that with lasers. And I've seen this actually when I was in university. They taking a laser and projected it on a special form of film. And what that does is that it shows the image in that on that film. But you take a snippet, as you say, from that, and you could still see the apple. And no matter how small the snippet is of that original picture, the apple still exists. And so this, too, also is part of the holographic universe in the sense that it doesn't matter what size the object, its existence is always there. In other words, the existence is actually a concept, an idea. It comes from the level of ideation. And you can create something from that state of ideation with a concept. And the concept, when you visualize that, it's already in existence the moment you visualize it. All you have to do now is bring it into reality. Mm-hmm. So if you take, you're a woodworker and you're going to make a table, you have an idea already in your head what that table is going to look like. So all you're doing is going through the physical motion, and you're bringing that table into existence.
Well, that could be
the brain. The brain of each individual is holographic.
Right. That could be great on one level. It could also be very dangerous on another level, don't you think? Depends on what you're thinking about, right?
Well, that's it. And so the real rule of thumb here is, be careful with what you think, thoughts are powerful constructs of words, and so or words are powerful constructs of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you think something in a rather negative or you know, non-positive way, you can, in some sense, have an effect upon that.
Affect it, yeah.
So it could be, too, that if people have a negative response to what they think ET is, perhaps they're influencing the ET encounter. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it gets into, this is a real tricky area, because this is where we need psychologists to come in and analyze and figure out the headspace of each individual who claims that they've had an ET encounter.
Right. Well, we have that. We have that.
That's right. And we get many, many different stories that come out of it. Some of them are fascinating. But at the same time, we also see where there's some kind of disorder that shows up, whether that person is schizophrenic, whether they're hallucinating, and all these kinds of things. And so it's up to the professional to try and figure out just where that person's head is at that moment. Obviously, as a child, when I went through my experience, I was reacting to what I was seeing in my environment.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Though I may not have understood it, I was reacting to it.
Yeah.
So it's a fight or flight response by most humans.
Right, right. So back to the holographic universe, our DNA, our very DNA, is a perfect example of one little bit of, you know, compare that to the pixel of the apple.
Exactly.
One little strand of DNA can make another human being, right?
Exactly. And, you know, it could be taken almost from any part of the body. As long as that sample is viable and fresh, yeah, you could do that. I don't know how it would work, say, if it was fossilized. I know that they've tried to, they've taken DNA from woolly mammoths, then they think that they can impregnate it into an elephant and create a woolly mammoth. That's a bit of biology that's beyond my understanding, but I think it's probable. You know, we can see all kinds of similar things around us. The obvious is the turkey and the chicken and the vulture and all the rest of it that appear to have aspects of prehistoric reptiles,
right,
particularly
right.
in their legs or their wings or their beaks. So we know that this is a possibility. When we look at the fact of DNA sampling, yeah, you're right. We can sample the DNA, and if it's fresh and viable, we can construct it. We can manipulate it into something else. We can interface it with another species DNA and create something that never existed. For instance, they can take the DNA of a jellyfish and put it into a pig, for instance, and that pig will glow in the dark.
Right, that's right. That's right.
Or a cat, or a dog, or a monkey, or anything like that. And, of course, the obvious question is, will they do that to human beings?
And
make us glow in the dark.
Relative to that is the parasperma. Am I using that right? Parasperma, where, you know, some of our DNA is off of stardust, coming from another planet, hitting
panspermia.
What is it?
Panspermia.
Panspermia. What did I say?
Yeah.
Panspermia? Panspermia, yeah.
Close enough.
Close enough. It started with the P. It's got the spermia in it.
Sure.
Anyway. yeah, so that's taking DNA and bringing it from another solar system or planet and depositing it here. Just like a dandelion seed being blown in the wind and landing somewhere else and growing that somewhere else, you know.
And, yes, and you know that's a real possibility, maybe even probability. I mean, they found the meteorite in Antarctica that they believe came from Mars, and it appeared to have fossilized bacteria on it. So this would be an indication that that certainly could be true. What's very interesting, and if you look at a comet and it's or a meteorite and it's headed towards, say, Earth or some other planet, the image that it conveys is a sperm and an ovum, and or an egg, and it's like the sperm is going to fertilize the egg, and from that life begins. Here's another aspect of the holographic paradigm, the holographic universe, that the macro is emulating the microscopic universe, even within humans. So there has to be something to this. This is like something worth really investigating, and not just sort of saying, is there a possibility, but let's get it nailed down. I think what we're going to find as we go out and explore all the planets, and NASA seems to be hinting at this, is that there's life not only on planets, but on some of its moons, like Enceladus and Titan and others. I think there's life on Mars. I've come across evidence of it through NASA's own raw photographs that the rover has taken, and that seem to indicate that there's some small life forms running around, and maybe at one time large intelligent humanoids running around, but maybe for some reason have died out.
Do you think, go ahead.
Yeah, and so I think what we're seeing here, like we're talking about maybe going to Mars one day, like through Elon Musk and colonizing. I don't know if that's such a great idea, because we may be finding that there is not only life there, but if life once existed on Mars and was wiped out, it may be going through a resurgence, in which case we really don't want to be interfering with that by colonization, because it's in a state of regenesis on Mars.
Could it be that the civilization... Civilization has gone underground.
That's true as well. There's evidence to support that there's not only surveillance drones of some kind that are following the rover as it moves around on the planet.
Oh, yeah.
And there is even video showing what looks like UFOs flying off the surface of Mars and over a mountaintop. So the thing is, NASA isn't talking about this. They're still saying, hey, we're hunting for life, and the life we're probably going to find is bacterial. But let's be a little more honest here. If you're finding bacterial life, there's probably an indication that there's highly evolved forms of life on there as well. And some of it may even be intelligent.
Maybe intelligent. And we may be ancestors, or they may be our ancestors, I should say.
Exactly. I believe that that's a real possibility. I mean, when we, and I describe this in my other books, I get right into this, and Mars is sort of the linchpin on all of this. But the thing about it is that, you know, when we look at the asteroid belt probably at one time was another planet, Planet 5.
Right.
Whatever that was called, we don't know. But there's a number of possibilities, and a couple of them is, one, that a comet or a meteorite hit the planet and it blew up.
Right.
And whatever life may have been on there was scattered across the solar system.
Right.
The other possibility is that not only was there life there, but it was highly intelligent, and they were trying to tap the energy of the planet by going to the core and trying to manipulate it some way, and something disastrous backfired, and again, the planet blew up.
Right.
And so what happened was the debris field scattered right across towards the sun, meaning across Mars, Earth, the Moon, Venus, and Mercury, as well as outward towards the outer planets.
Terry?
And so,
I'm sorry. I got to cut you off. I'm very sorry. Terry Tabana, I'm really glad you were able to join us, but we've just run out of time.
Well, it happens. I just like to say before we end this is, again, my book is available from Amazon, from Barnes & Noble, Ingram Sparks, Indigo, and many, many others. And if your bookstore doesn't have it, get them to order it in.
Oh, good. And thank you, Terry.
Thank you very much, David.
If you have any, if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage and Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to whfr.fm, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 12 noon, when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Winner of the Spirit of College Radio Award, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
The Hawk's Nest is holding a food drive to help restock the pantry for those in need. Help fight food insecurity on Henry Ford College's campus by making a donation of food or personal hygiene products today. Items can be donated now through November 8th at the Hawk's Nest in the ASCC Building L, room 138, or the Office of Student Activities in the Student Center Building M, room 105. For more information or questions, please call 313-317-1756.
Cliff Bells will be hosting a very special WHFR Jazz Benefit on Sunday, November 17th. Please join us for an evening of jazz improvisation starring Dave Hurley and the Outer Nebula Trio, featuring Raphael Staton, Bear Trap, Michael Malice's Exploration Ensemble, Planetary Citizenship, featuring O'Donnell, Spangler, Bergman, Wallace, and CUNY. Doors open at 7 o'clock. All ages welcome. Minors must be accompanied by an adult. All proceeds from the $10 donation entry fee go directly to WHFR. We hope to see you at Cliff Bell's on Sunday, November 17th for WHFR's Jazz Benefit. Please visit WHFR.fm for more information.
Yo, guys and dolls, this is Daddy G. And the Mouth Shop is moving to a new time slot. 1 p.m. every Tuesday here in WHFR. We're still spinning the platters from the 50s and 60s just an hour earlier. That's 1 p.m. every Tuesday on 89.3 FM. WHFR.fm. Be there or be square.
Come on, pretty baby, won't you come on with me? I got a whole lot of loving that I would love you to see. Now, I don't even know where this adventure could lead. It could get heavy if you're ready when we keep the rocking steady. Oh, will you ride a white rock with me? We're gonna keep it on the ride while you're feeling the pain. Cause we're gonna rip it up at the Jitterbug Jukebox Jump.